Since the dawn of civilization, spies of every nation and culture have worked to infiltrate their adversaries and glean the information that will give their side the advantage. The stakes are sky high, the strategies varied and imaginative, and the ultimate sign of success is that no one ever even knew you were there. In each episode, we will explore the moral and ethical gray zones of espionage, where treachery and betrayal go hand in hand with cunning and courage. This is the Spycraft 101 podcast. Welcome to your clandestine classroom. This is episode number one of the Spycraft 101 podcast. Today I'm speaking with Andrew Joseph Blasco, author of the new novel Kill Kitchener, the first in a series about Fritz Joubert Duquesne. Duquesne grew up in South Africa and led an incredible life of adventure. At varying times in his life, he was a soldier, a saboteur, a spy, a big game hunter, a con artist, and even an advisor to President Teddy Roosevelt. He was also a consummate liar and showman, so during this episode, Andrew and I try to separate fact from fiction. Andrew, hey, thank you for joining me today.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Great, great. You know, from my perspective, we're going to talk about Fritz Duquesne today, and I know you know about more about him than just about anyone else I can imagine right now. From what I've read, from what I've seen, it really seems like he led one of the most incredible lives of anyone over the past 150 years or so. I know that he was a soldier, he was a big game hunter, he was an escape artist, a spy, a saboteur, he just did it all. So it seems like he walked down almost every path to adventure that you could imagine. But there's also a lot of myths and a lot of rumors about his life, and many of them were perpetuated by him directly, intentionally. So I want to try to take this time to set the record as straight as we possibly can with your help. So can you kind of take us back to the beginning of Fritz Duquesne's life and just show us how he became the man that he did?
Sure, sure. Yeah, so in the beginning, I mean, so he grew up, born and grew up in South Africa, what's currently South Africa today. He came from parents that were in a pedigree that came from Europe, that immigrated to Europe. That immigrated from Europe to South Africa along with a lot of the other Dutch that showed up. He basically set the foundation for the rest of his life there, just kind of, you know, exploring and hunting and, you know, getting into various different adventures, you know, in South Africa and, you know, nearly dying, saving lives, you know, many times over. So he kind of, you know, built almost like a frontiersman kind of sensibility. That was kind of one of the things that, I mean, one of the major things that kind of drew me to him and wanted to learn more about him was because he was so, you could draw parallels to, you know, kind of American frontiersman as well. That kind of, you know, being from Pennsylvania and, you know, having an affinity for the old West. I mean, it just kind of, there's another guy over there that, you know, in Africa, that's an adventurer as well. So he grew up in South Africa, had to deal with, you know, many of the natural kind of elements, I guess you would say, growing up there constantly with the native tribesmen, you know, wild animals. I mean, lion attacks were, you know, a common occurrence, you know, up into the 20th century, where, I mean, you really had to protect yourself. It was very much, you know, equatable to the Wild West. So he grew up there, he was killing people when he was a preteen.
A preteen?
Yeah. He said, I mean, of course, it's, you know, it's unverifiable, but, you know, in most of his, you know, biographies and such, he said that he killed his first man when he was 12 years old. So, I mean, it goes back a while. And so he already had like a body count, you know, before he ever went to war. Whenever the war came along, he actually spent some time abroad, spent a little bit of time in, you know, the modern UK, in France, rest of Europe as well. This is kind of, I mean, there is documentation that he's got, that he went to Europe, of course, but before the war and even during the war, there's not a whole lot of, I guess, proof of his exploits. And before, I guess, we get into like, you know, what the legend of him right now, but there was a lot of false statements, I guess, made by him. He said that he was the fencing champion of Europe, and he killed people fencing and stuff. And there's just no documentation for him saying that. But I mean, back 120 years ago, you could say whatever you wanted. I mean, there was no internet. So, I mean, there's documentation that someone would have to really, really try very hard to go find and verify, you know, a lot of his claims. But I mean, he was just such a good talker and such a good bullshitter. I mean, he could talk about things and people would think that they're true. whenever the war broke out in South Africa in the late 19th century.
Right, right, absolutely.
He did participate in that war. According to him, he participated in it, got captured, and was confined in modern-day Mozambique, escaped, went up to Europe, and joined the British Army as an undercover, and then came back to South Africa as a British officer, and then participated in the war that way, and basically betrayed the British then, doing that. Now, I mean, the way that, you know, the ranks and stuff were set up, that just, I mean, unless he was a very, very good liar, there's not any documentation that that actually happened. I mean, it's a great story. There's no proof that that actually occurred.
I got you. Yeah, that makes sense. That's kind of one of the defining characteristics of his life is there's not a lot of proof, but here's what he said.
Right. You know, exactly. I mean, listen, they're really neat stories. They are. I mean, and I mean, I have a copy of Clement Wood's biography of him, which was published in the, you know, the early 30s. And it's definitely interesting. It's an interesting read. Duquesne actually tried to make it into a movie. At one point, he held the movie rights for a little bit, and because he, you know, whenever he was in America, he's just like, hey, man, let's go to Hollywood, let's make it into a movie, and, you know, let's try to become more famous. But we'll get that a little bit later on. But I mean, even with all the lies and stuff they told about the war, he was, you know, he did fight in the war. He was injured in the war. Wow. He was captured. I mean, verifiably captured and held toward the end or towards the middle of the war. Yeah, the Second Boer War, which was 1898 to 1901. And it all took place in South Africa, modern day South Africa, between the British Empire and the Boer Republics, the Orange Free State and South African Republic, or what's called the Transvaal. So those two tiny little farming republics went up against the British Empire. And it seems like the British Empire always goes up against like small farming nations for some reason. Right. But yeah, they really give them a run for their money. But you know, they were overpowered by the British Empire. But there's all sorts of stuff that he made up during that war, too. Like he helped President Kruger, you know, get a bunch of gold out of the country. And then he stashed some gold and it's Kruger's millions and it's hidden somewhere. And, you know, I talk to people in South Africa today and they still believe that, hey, this gold's out there, when in actuality, they found a bunch of it in a Swiss bank just this past year. So they had it. And then the South African government, they're like, hey, this is ours. Oh, wow. And they're actually selling it. You can actually buy pieces of Kruger's gold that he took up there to help fund the war in Europe, because President Kruger fled to Europe at the time, took a bunch of money with him to help fund it from abroad. But I mean, yeah, Duquesne said that he helped him get out of Dodge and stashed a bunch of gold somewhere in the ground somewhere in South Africa. People ate that up. I mean, everybody loves a good story like that. Yeah. So I personally think that's another fabrication. I don't think there's any truth to that whatsoever. But, you know, I talk to people all the time. And they said, oh, yeah, it's out there. Totally. They get all excited about it. But I just don't think it is. But he was captured during the war, was held down in Cape Town, did try to escape, failed in that. They had a bunch of rocks fall on him. He was tunneling through the wall, about a bunch of rocks fell on him. And they pulled him out of there. He was part of a mission to do some sabotage in Cape Town. All 19 of his companions were shot. He was allowed to live because he gave up some phony codes that he said that the Boers used.
We'll be right back.
Roe is dead.
Supreme Court has delivered another blow to the Voting Rights Act.
Despite growing dangers from climate change, tonight the U.S. Supreme Court curbing the government's power to fight it.
The makeup of the Supreme Court, the decisions they have already handed down, and the cases they are hearing this year are not coincidental. So what is next? What can we expect from this chaos court and the networks at work to serve them up cases that will expedite their agenda? We'll seek to answer those questions, examining issues at the heart of the cases the court is currently deciding. Follow Grave Injustice wherever you get your podcasts. We're releasing episodes every Thursday throughout the season.
Oh, wow. Is this verified information? This is not one of his stories?
This is not one of his stories. And that's the thing. So, like, he wove all this absolute complete crap and with amazing things that are verifiably true. So he didn't need to make this whole make up all these other different stories. His own life was amazing enough, but that's what he did. But he was part of basically spying in Cape Town at the time, and they caught him. One of his members of the ring turned on him. He was able to say, hey, you know, if I give you this information, let's cut a deal and let me live. And they said, yeah. And he was able to make up basically on the spot a whole bunch of BS about these codes that the uh, that the Boer armies were using, and they let him go. They say they commuted his sentence. They say, okay, you're just going to go serve life imprisonment on Bermuda. You know, put on a ship, send him over there. So he went to Bermuda then and served almost the rest of the war in Bermuda. While he was in prison in Bermuda, which he was verifiable, he was in prison there in solitary confinement in Bermuda on the island there. He actually spoke to reporters and such. I've read articles from a reporter that interviewed him on Bermuda, and he fed this reporter a bunch of lies, which I thought was hilarious. It was like he was telling him that he was from France. And he was speaking to him in French, because, I mean, that's the one thing about him, too. He spoke multiple languages, and he was speaking to him in French. And he's like, oh, yeah, I'm from France. I'm here. You know, I was imprisoned here falsely and blah, 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 blah. And fed him, just wove him this bunch of BS about being a Frenchman. And it was funny how the reporter actually said in it, he said, yeah, I spoke to this guy, Fritz Joubert Duquesne. Said he was a Frenchman, blah, 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 and, you know, all this stuff. He's like, which I thought was very odd, because he also spoke Afrikaans perfectly. So he spoke the native language of all the whites in South Africa. So he's like, even that reporter was like, you know what? I don't really believe him. A lot of the stuff that he just told me. So it was kind of funny. It was kind of funny that story that I read, it's verifiable that he was there. He ended up swimming and escaping captivity there. Again, unverifiable proof, but he hung around in Hamilton and Bermuda for a while, for a week or so. Did a little bit of like odd jobs, was helping turn some tricks for some local prostitutes. I mean, to make a little bit of extra money, and then stow away to board a ship. Headed for Baltimore. He said, like, you know, I got to get off this island, you know, sooner or later. So he did. They discovered him on board, and they said, you're going to be turned over to local authorities. Like, we're not messing around with you. We know you're a prisoner, you know. And he actually fessed up to them, saying, yeah, I escaped, and, you know, let me stay in America. And they're like, no way, dude. Like, you're going to the police. He jumped ship in the Chesapeake Bay and swam aboard, and then just, you know, hiked on foot all the way to New York. So all that stuff is verifiable as well.
Can't believe that he actually told the truth when he was finally cornered. Doesn't seem like his MO.
Yeah, he's like reading Clement Wood's book, his biography. That was one of the kind of things I was like, you know what? I mean, Wood's book is full of things that were proven false. But that was one of the things that I'm like, you know what? That kind of makes sense. Whenever he was talking about that part, whenever he was aboard that ship. And I forget what the name of the yacht was. But it was a big deep blue cruiser that he was aboard. And it was basically a luxury yacht. What he said to the people aboard was like, hey, no, I'm a Boer. I fought in South Africa. I don't need to lie anymore. I can just tell you the truth of who I am, because I'm in America. And basically, I can do whatever I want. They was like, no, you can't. And that's basically, in the biography, basically said, like, you know, hey, I don't need to hide who I am. I can say, you know, what I want. He kind of, you know, screwed himself, or not really screwed himself, but he thought it would be okay, when it definitely wasn't. So
yeah, all sins are not forgiven over here.
Right. Jumps ship and hikes, just basically goes on foot to, you know, up to Philadelphia, then up to New York, finds Boer sympathizers there. They basically help him find a job at the New York Herald. And he started like in the mailroom and stuff. And then he started, you know, writing a little bit of stories here and there. And then he basically got his own column writing, you know, adventure stuff and hunting stories at the New York Herald. And at that time, like, basically it's like, you know, the war had ended. He could have gone back to South Africa if he wanted to. He had to swear allegiance to the crown, which he's like, no, bag that. I'm not doing that. And he had no reason to go back to South Africa either, because all of his family was dead. Yeah, his family, his farm was burned. His family was all killed or murdered during the war. So he's like, he had no reason to go back. So he stayed in New York.
Andrew, I've read that he located his own mother in a British concentration camp. Is that another fake story, or do you know if that really happened or not?
There's no way to verify that. Actually, you know what? There might be a way to verify it, is to look at the records of all the camps and see if she was in there. But I don't know if all the stuff that he said about it was true or not. All of his family, he had a brother and a sister, a father and a mother. All of them were, and blind old uncle too, and they shot or hung all of them. They raped his mother, put her in the camp. She actually gave birth to another baby after being raped in the camp, and she was just dying of syphilis. She wasn't making out. She was basically at the end of her life there. And the thing about the concentration camps during the Boer War, I mean, 10% of the population of South Africa died in those camps. So, I mean, and this was, that's all very well documented. And there were PR campaigns and activism campaigns to stop those treatments of civilians, because they're all civilians that were shoved in those camps. That scorched earth policy is definitely, you know, not the finest hour of British history. Wow. Yeah, they still get a lot of heat from it today. But yeah, so his whole family was eradicated during the war, and he's just like, I'm not going back. But he did, through those events, say, like, basically his personal mission to cause and inflict as much pain on the British people as possible, as he possibly could. Whenever he was going back to America, New York, he was in New York and writing for that paper, was a foreign correspondent for a while. I mean, he went to Russia and, you know, all throughout Europe and, you know, all over the world being a war correspondent. So he was everywhere working for those guys and wrote a lot of interesting hunting articles, and actually caught the attention of Teddy Roosevelt. 100% true. Teddy Roosevelt said, like, this guy writing these stories is amazing. And Teddy Roosevelt's like wants to kill like everything on the planet. he's like, I got to talk to this guy. And he met with Duquesne. Duquesne gave him actually some shooting lessons. So he gave shooting lessons to Teddy Roosevelt. Fritz Duquesne helped Teddy Roosevelt run his last presidential election in the state of New York. So he was all basically on his campaign staff, writing stuff for him. So again, amazing history of this guy. And during this time, you know, met someone, settled down, got married. And after he lost, after Teddy Roosevelt lost that last presidential race, he said, like, I'm leaving. Teddy Roosevelt said, I'm going to Africa. I'm going across the world. I'm going to go on the biggest safari I've ever seen in my life. Duquesne helped outfit his safari. He's like, you got to take these guns. You got to take all this stuff with you. You know, this is everything you need to get you through Africa. He's like, okay. He wanted Duquesne to come with him, but he just got married, and he's like, I'm just gonna stay here. So that all happened. Kept writing stories. Helped found the Adventurers Club in New York, where he would talk about Africa and going on these adventures and a bunch of his lies about all the stuff that he did in Europe, being a fencing champion and escaping prison in Europe and all this other BS, and everybody would just get around, have lunch, have drinks and listen to everybody's stories. And he always told the best ones. So he worked doing that and being a writer for quite some time. And then towards, after the early 1910s, somewhere in that time, started working on a piece of legislation. He would actually link up with an old foe of his during the Boer War. So there's a guy, an American, his actual job, his name was Frederick Russell Burnham, and his actual job, you can see it on his Wikipedia page, his job was frontiersman. I was like, that was like, in back in 1900, yeah, you could have a job. It was called frontiersman. And this guy could just track anything and shoot anything and go kill anything. And they hired him to go hunt down Duquesne because he was such a pain in the ass to the British Empire in South Africa. I mean, he was a big threat. He kept blowing up bridges and assassinating people. And he were like, you need to go kill this guy. Yeah, so they hired Burnham to go and hunt down Duquesne. And then when he was in America, he actually met up with him, you know, apart from his rivalry. And they said, like, hey, we need to do something about the meat shortage. There was a meat shortage in early 20th century America. And Duquesne said, let's bring over hippos from Africa. He's like, we used to eat that stuff all the time. He's like, they're easy to feed. They eat anything and they're huge and they provide a ton of meat. He said that, I mean, I've actually read his congressional testimony before. He testified before Congress saying, bring over the hippo. He's like, we used to eat that stuff all the time in Africa. So he wrote testimony, testified before Congress, teamed up with his old foe from Africa. Now, there's a little bit of, you know, hey, did these guys work together to inflate their own egos and their own stories? Maybe, probably. You know, they were both in positions to do it. They both were, you know, writing stories, writing books, doing a lot of press and stuff and making each other famous and basically say, hey, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. You know, I'll say how big of a badass you were. You say how big of a badass I was. Like, okay, you got it. So maybe that's some of that was going on, unverified, but there's theories. But yeah, I mean, and that is, you can read that in an article called The American Hippo, and it outlines their rivalry in trying to bring the American hippopotamus to come to fruition. They wanted to put it in Louisiana bayous to eat up all the, there's invasive kind of species kind of clogging up the shipping lanes down there. and also, you know, accommodate that meat shortage. So build and pass. We don't have hippos in America. So, but it's an amazing story that you can read in an article that you get for free online. So that kind of like led up into World War One. During World War One, this was a time whenever Duquesne was like, here we go. Germany's back at it. I have an opportunity to inflict some pain on the British because they're going to war. They're going to war against the Central Powers in Europe. Here we go. So at this point, divorced from his wife. He wasn't really a good husband. He's kind of a dirtbag, actually. Treated her pretty poorly. Made her get a bunch of like abortions that she didn't want to have. So he's not really a great guy. Even though he's done all these like very interesting things, this big adventure, he's also done a lot of like, you know, very, very mean things. So
yeah, absolutely.
World War One breaks out, ends up going to South America, to go to Brazil. You know, hits up the German embassies down there. He's like, listen, here's what I've done in my past. I want to come work for you guys. And they said, yeah, sure. We'll throw some money at you. So he was paid by, you know, German intelligence down there, and took on a couple of different aliases. He started blowing up ships. So he spoke multiple languages. Like I said, spoke Dutch. Afrikaans and Dutch are, you know, Afrikaans is a cousin of Dutch. So you speak one, you can understand it. Hmm. He started posing as a guy from the Netherlands, I think it was, putting mineral samples and flowers and tulips and stuff like that in the boxes. Well, this stuff in the boxes, they're just bombs. And he would talk people up on the docks and stuff, say, oh, you know, I'm a professor. I got to get this stuff back to the Netherlands. He's like, take this for me, take this onto the ship for me. He would insure these boxes and of these mineral samples and sometimes films. Film back then was incredibly expensive. Like people don't understand, like, it's not like a roll of Kodak. Like this, these are, you know, tens of thousands of dollars worth of film back then. So yeah, you wanted to insure it. Of course, there was no film, though. I mean, he was posing as a naturalist or something like that to get these guys to take this stuff back to Europe. And ships would go offshore, and they were all merchant vessels, bringing over raw materials from South America back to Britain to, you know, make into whatever they needed for the war effort. And they'd blow up and they'd sink. And it was, you know, many ships he did this to. He insured all of it. And part of his own ego, he kept all the newspaper clippings of all the stuff that happened. That actually brought him down.
Really?
Whenever they're after him, they're like, okay, you know, we're seeing a pattern here. British intelligence, they're like, MI5 is like, we know something's going on. This is all kind of happening. The spy ring down there, that this was this sabotage spy ring. They're like, yeah, it's this guy. This guy's, you know, Fritz Duquesne, and that's the guy that you want. And they start chasing him down there for blowing up ships and murder on the high seas. And that's what they charged him with. I mean, I don't know if that's still a crime now, murder on the high seas, but I think that's what they charged him with back then. Ran and escaped and, you know, evaded capture down in South America, faked his own death, used his publishing contacts and stuff back in New York and wrote an article saying, hey, Fritz Duquesne's dead. And everybody believed it. So everybody thinking that he was dead, they're like, okay, we'll call off, you know, the dogs, made his way back to America and started doing other things under a different alias. And even though he does say whenever he was arrested later on, though, because he was eventually arrested because he went back to cash in all these insurance claims, you know, he wanted to get some money. And they're like, what? Like, who are you? And how are you getting this money? So the insurance companies kind of, they opened up their own investigations and everything like that. Of course, they really would nowadays, but they did back then because they thought that something was askew. So,
which it was, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So he ended up actually getting arrested and charged with some crimes. And he said, I mean, part of the interesting thing his like testimony, I guess, in his defense was, yeah, he did admit to doing some of those things, you know, against the British Empire for Germany. He says, oh, but this was all before I was, before the U.S. was in the war. Like, I'm a U.S. citizen. I think he was naturalized as a U.S. citizen and 1914 or something like that, 1913. But he's like, oh, I'm a U.S. citizen. Like, I would never do anything against, you know, the U.S. government. You know, never. You know, that's a complete lie. Yeah, in Wood's book, he says that, and it's just bunch of crap. So
right. It is like everything else he ever.
Yeah, said. A lot of things conflict in that book. So, anyways, he ends up, you know, getting arrested and everything. But then he was they let him go, absolved him of everything, and they say, okay, you're fine. You know, you can do whatever you want, and kept living in America up into the 30s. Whenever he started seeing, you know, the Nazi Party come to power, joined the German intelligence service in the 30s, started working with those guys against the British. Once more, he saw an opportunity.
Andrew, do you think that there was an ideological alignment there? It sounds like he only ever believed in maybe himself.
Oh,
more than anything else, and you know, getting back at the Brits. But did he have any? Did he have any ideological beliefs at all, other than that?
You know what? I mean, I know that he really wasn't religious. He wasn't really religious. He really didn't have a country to call his own. And saying that he only had belief in just like himself, he basically rose himself to be like, okay, I am the only, you know, player in the world. And my enemy is the British Empire, or anybody that is British. And it doesn't matter whose heads I have to trample on to do that, even if it's my his own country, of, you know, which was the United States at the time. He's like, I don't care what their interests are. I'm out for my own interests and out for his own ego too. So yeah, 100%. The only people he ever cared about was himself. He did work for German intelligence up in the 30s, and you know, going into World War II, and started the largest spy ring in America that was ever brought down, the Duquesne spy ring.
Do you know how he did that exactly? What I mean. He obviously has an ability to convince anyone of anything. So I can very much see him, you know, being able to co-opt a lot of people and being able to spot and assess the kind of people that would be willing to work with him. But do you have any specifics on what he did to develop that spy ring?
That particular spy ring? No, I don't. It's something that I need to dive a little bit deeper on. I mean, because my research, 100%, being honest with you, I did a whole bunch of research on his entire life beginning to end, and then focused on pre-World War I for my first book. But the Duquesne spy ring is really, really interesting, because there were so many, just A, how big it was, the double agents involved, the technology that they are trying to give over to the Germans. I mean, it was amazing that all the stuff that they were trying to do. And there's a video online, and I think you may or may not have seen it, but J. Edgar Hoover was talking about it. He actually narrated himself, the video, saying, here's Fritz Duquesne, and he's bringing in, he's giving this information over to this double agent, and, you know, it's drawings of the M1 Garand, and, you know, this tank that we're developing, and, you know, all these different boats and stuff. And in that same video, Duquesne's like looking around the room, looking for like hidden cameras and microphones and stuff. And for this guy that was on his own team, I mean, he thought that this double agent was his guy, and he still didn't trust him. So it was really, really interesting. And they actually made a movie. Hollywood made a movie that was based on the Duquesne spy ring. And I forget what it's called, but they made a movie that is based on it.
I'll have to look for that for sure. That sounds incredible.
So speaking of movies, so kind of going back to the American Hippopotamus and him doing all that stuff, Ed Norton's company, they bought the rights to that article back in like 2014, I think it was, and they said they were going to make a movie on that. Now it's stalled, and it's about the Burnham Duquesne rivalry and the American Hippopotamus, but nothing's kind of fruition.
That would make for an incredible period piece for sure. I think a lot of people would love.
Yeah, to see. It'd be really, really interesting. So World War II kind of comes up, and, you know, obviously they bring him down. They bring down the spy ring. They put him in jail, and they're like, hey, you're going to jail this time for sure. So they put him in jail. They lock him up for good. Him being himself, he feigns paralysis to get into basically a prison hospital. So he feigned paralysis for 2 years. And they're sticking, and to test him, they're sticking needles and stuff in his feet, So like far into his feet.
Oh my God.
And he was able to just grin and bear it. You say like, oh yeah, I don't feel a thing. And they're like, yeah, this guy's paralyzed. Like this guy, and he faked it so well for so long that at the end of the 2 years, whenever he was ready to escape, because he escaped, he was actually like, his like legs didn't move. like in Kill Bill. You see Kill Bill?
Yes, yes.
How Uma Thurman's character, like she woke up from the coma and her legs didn't move, like in the, but she got him moving. Yeah. They're like, that was him. That was
just atrophied away.
Wow. Yeah. He got his That's legs incredible. Moving again and escaped from that hospital. And then he was out and then got captured again, back in jail. And then he got really, really sick. I mean, he was just all beat up. I mean, he had mental problems at that point. He had cancer. He had a dislocated shoulder that just never reset properly. I mean, the guy was just falling apart. You're not going anywhere. You're not a flight risk. You're not really a danger to anybody. We're going to let you out and we're going to let you die. And that was in the 50s. Hmm. And he went back to the Adventure Club and gave another speech. And he really was like unwelcome because at that point he was un-American. I mean, back in the 50s, and that was, you know, hey, we just beat the Germans. You know, I mean, that was all in his mind. Everybody knew who he was, not really necessarily knowing that a lot of it was BS. I think there's a lot of people who said like, yeah, this guy's just a bullshit.
Right, right.
He was very unwelcome at that last speech and that last meeting. And he was talking about his life as, you know, going to jail, getting out of jail, all of his espionage stuff. And he was not welcome. End up dying.
Wow. Yeah, the times changed.
Sure. Yeah. And then he ended up dying and being put on Welfare Island in New York, where they buried just a bunch of prisoners. And it's Roosevelt Island now. And you go visit his grave there. It's just a small, basic prison grave, basically. So he definitely has a story arc that is, I think it was probably fit for a Scorsese. Everybody just kind of fails at the end and, you know, ends up as a shell of their former selves.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Definitely an interesting life, but a lot of it BS at the same time.
So speaking of that, I know that your book is called Kill Kitchener. And that seems like one of the incidents that he's most famously associated with. So is that something that he was really a part of, or is that another one of his stories, do you think?
So that is up for debate, actually. So he said that, so Lord Kitchener was, I mean, he was Secretary of War at the time, was headed to Russia to help negotiate some involvement in the war there during World War I. He reached out to German intelligence. They shipped him off to Germany after they, so whenever the British MI5 were after him and everything like that, he faked his own death. He was able to hitch a ride with the Germans over to Germany, kept him there for a little bit. And they're like, oh, hey, you know, Lord Kitchener, who's in charge, the British war effort in South Africa and who he blamed for killing his family. They're like, oh, he's, you know, headed to Russia. And he's like, let's do it. Like, let's kill this guy. This is his story. So his story was being with the Germans, and they disguised him as a Russian diplomat, Boris Zakrevsky. They said, we captured this guy. You're going to be Boris now. So they dressed him up in Boris's clothes, and they got him on board the ship with Kitchener. His story was, you know, he was on the ship with Kitchener and signaled a submarine to torpedo the ship that he was on north of the Orkney Islands of Scotland and sunk that ship. Now, there are newspaper accounts saying, hey, there's this person here. This person lived. He jumped ship. And he was like, yeah, that was me. Was it him? It's up for debate. Some people say, yes, that ship, you know, that had Kitchener aboard. It was sunk by a torpedo. Some say that it hit a mine, a sea mine, and it sank. Again, up for debate. It's kind of one of his things. It's like, yeah, there's no way to absolutely verify it, but he did take credit for it. But that was in my book, which is a fictionalized version of this guy who fictionalized his own life. So I took a lot of his own stories, rearranged them in such a way to make just a better storyline, better story arc. Because if you read something like Woods' book, it's just a bunch of like short stories and he's everywhere and he did everything. And of course, if you write your own biography, and everybody's going to believe it, you write whatever you want. To kind of touch on that too, Clement Woods' biography of him, I have a theory that Duquesne actually wrote that book. I don't think that Clement Wood wrote that book.
Really?
Just because Clement Wood was a Southerner, only met Duquesne a couple of times. And for all the detail that this guy Wood wrote about Duquesne, it's all the detail and it's all the way how he wrote too. There's just too many Britishisms, too many British spellings, like stuff that Americans don't say. they don't say this. They don't spell things this way. It's like someone with a more of a British background would write this stuff. And too many times I came across, I'm like, this doesn't make any sense. Like, no American would write this. So I actually think that Fritz Duquesne wrote his own biography and gave it to Clement Wood saying, hey, you publish this. I keep getting into trouble because whenever he met Wood, he was under an alias. He was under the alias Frederick Fredericks. So he had like 7 different aliases. So he made, you know, that's how he made his money kind of, you know, in the 20s, into the 30s. He would be under a different alias, and he would go and give speeches saying, I was the Australian light cavalry and I did this or whatever in this war. And you just start making stuff up. And he went on the electric circuits and made money that way. So he was always just a BSer about everything and made money that way. I mean, he didn't make himself rich, but he got by and lived a really interesting life.
Yeah. The man was incredibly self-reliant.
Yeah.
It sounds like, well, yeah, I mean, you've convinced me. I'm thinking for sure now that he ghost wrote his own biography, which really lines up perfectly with his ego and his penchant for bragging and everything. So that's really just an incredible masterstroke there, honestly, is to leave a falsified record that you wrote yourself and attribute it to somebody else.
Yeah.
So that you don't take the blame for the inaccuracies.
Right. And here's another thing. Like, so his ability to convince people and go to bat for him. He was arrested. I forget what this was, but I think it was in the 20s or 30s. And it was definitely in the 30s. So it was there, because Wood biography came out in like 32. So it was in the 30s. He was arrested again, saying, hey, is this Duquesne? Like, we've arrested this guy. You wrote the biography on him. You got to come up and identify and say, yes, this is Duquesne. He's like, no, this is another guy. This is Frederick Fredericks. Duh. Or Frederick Craven. Another alias was Major Craven. He's like, I've known Major Craven for 5 years. And just, Wood's just BS for him to get him out of jail.
Wow.
So that again, that's a testament for his ability to A, just convince people of all these lies, and then also go to bat for him for his lies to evade any sort of capture or punishment. So pretty amazing. I mean, and maybe it was, maybe mm-hmm. Wood had a different reason to do it, but I don't know.
That's amazing. Yeah. You know, that does make perfect sense to me. So what an incredible life lived despite all the falsehoods out there and the myths and everything. I mean, he's no doubt lived life to the fullest.
Yeah.
Living only for himself as well.
Yeah. To some people, he was an absolute hero. I mean, there's a lot of families and prominent political families in South Africa at the time were still held him in very high regard. The early 20th century and the 20s and the 30s saying, oh yes, we were really good friends with him and blah, blah, blah. And were they lying on top of his lies to build? I don't know. But I mean, he was still a hero down there at the time. There were, I mean, down South Africa at the time, though, was you found because it bordered German East Africa. So like modern day Angola and such down there. So there was a lot of German citizens down there and a lot of German sympathizers. I mean, and by extension, later in the century, a lot of Nazi sympathizers. So. The stuff that he did during World War I and World War II, he still held in high regard. So, yeah, so I mean, it's in my book. I mean, I kind of, you know, layer in other different kind of historical figures from Ireland and South Africa and America. They probably crossed paths here and there, but my stuff's a work of fiction. So, you know, I made stuff up and reorganized things in his life to make it fit my narrative, you know, a little bit better. And, you know, in my book, he's the anti-hero.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like I said before, he's not a great guy. He's not one of the good guys. Yeah. You're rooting for him because you sympathize with his actions. But whenever you really look at him, he's an anti-hero. Not the best of human beings.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But it's a riveting story no matter what.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, it's amazing. I mean, some of the stuff that he pulled off, some stories put James Bond to shame.
They really do. So you've got your first book, Kill Kitchener, is already published. When's the next one coming out?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. So I'm working on it. I'm writing it now. I mean, the end of the year is our target date for publication of that one. I don't know where it's going to end up. I wanted to bring it up to the end of World War I. Because that has a lot of good closure for, you know, some of my characters that might end before that, but it's not going to end after that. I'll take the story up until, you know, the day Duquesne dies. So, I mean, we're looking at 3 or 4 books. and that I've been contracted to write. It's been fun. It's been a lot of fun to take his story and develop new characters that work with him and fight him and try to kill him, and he kills them. And it's fun doing the based on a true story kind of stuff. It gives you a little bit of freedom, but also gives you a good true scaffolding to work off of.
Oh yeah, you've got great source material to work from, no question.
Yeah. I mean, even if it's complete crap. I mean, even if it's complete lies, it's like still good stories.
Absolutely.
So I mean, stories that people bought into for decades. I mean, if you go look up his bibliography, I mean, he has a lot of published works, film accounts and articles that he wrote for many different papers and magazines and stuff. A lot of it's, hunting and adventure related. So anybody that's kind of, interested in hunting or adventure or safaris or wildlife or anything like that would really take to Duquesne, but also has, that Venn diagram of all the war stuff, all the spy stuff. I mean, like you said in the beginning, he did it all. He really did.
He really did. He really did. Andrew, this has been really fascinating. I got to admit, I'm looking forward to your second book. I've already got your first one, of course, which is how we first linked up. Can you tell me, I know that a lot of people are going to hear this and they're going to be interested. How can they get a hold of you?
Go to my website, which is andrewbelasco.com. You can hit up my Instagram. I got Twitter. I got Facebook. Ways to connect with me through any of those means. And I'd be happy to talk with you. Happy to talk with you about Duquesne or Africa or America or, the exploits during the war or anything like that. So yeah, feel free to reach out to me anytime.
Thanks, Andrew. Well, I know you and I are going to stay in contact, no question about it.
Yeah.
And I really appreciate you taking time to talk to me about Duquesne as well today. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. No, anytime. I appreciate you setting this up. It's been a lot of fun.
It really has. All right. Thanks, man. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Disclaimer. This podcast is produced for your universal listening pleasure. Any statements shared during our program are opinions and experiences of our team and guests. If you disagree with any content presented herein, please find another show before submitting nasty grams. This is a positive vibes only platform. If you love our show and want to connect, share your experiences, or know someone who we should interview on future episodes, please don't hesitate to get in touch through our website or Instagram.
Thanks for listening to this program brought to you by Daydreamer Network. If you enjoyed the episode, please don't forget to rate and review on Apple Podcasts or your preferred platform. Your feedback allows us to rank on the best new shows list and continue to grow our podcasts in order to bring more unique and talented storytellers to the network. To check out our shows, including programs about relationships, sports, business, nutrition, leisure, and more, head to www.daydreamernetwork.com. We look forward to seeing you back next week for another great episode. Have a wonderful day.